You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Even those only vaguely familiar with Cuba or the Cuban Revolution know the names Fidel Castro and Che Guevara. While the importance of those two cannot be overstated, no revolution can proceed without the help of a great many people whose names are either forgotten or never known. One person who is very well known in Cuba is Celia Sanchez, an important planner of the revolution, a confidant to Fidel Castro. Celia Sanchez, however, is little known in the English-speaking world. Nancy Stout has written a new biography of Celia Sanchez. Nancy is a writer and photographer. She's also a reference librarian at Fordham University in New York City. And we've reached Nancy at her home in New York. Good morning, Nancy, and welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Hi. Nice to speak to you.
Given what I said, that names like Fidel Castro and Che Guevara are very well known, but Celia Sanchez in Canada, I can only speak for that, is probably a very strange name. What drew you to write her biography?
Well, I had done a couple of books in Cuba that were basically photography books, and I wrote the text on at least one of them. And her name kept coming up. I was interested in architecture, and then I realized that she'd really been the developer of some of the biggest projects, Lennon Park, the Coppelia Ice Cream Parlor, the Convention Center are just three, but there are many restaurants and hotels, and her name just kept coming up. And I returned after the first book, which is in the early 90s, to do a second one on the cigar industry, because I guess I couldn't resist going back. And I walked into the Cohiba cigar factory, and here was this huge portrait of her, and she really also started that. And it just grew from there, became irresistible.
Well, before the Cuban Revolution, I guess, what are we talking about? What year was Celia born in?
She was born in 1920.
Okay. So, and we have the revolution in 1959. What can you tell us about Celia Sanchez, her early life before the Cuban Revolution? I guess we're talking now in, the 40s and so on, 50s maybe.
Well, I think it's important to talk about how she was brought up. Her father was a doctor, a country doctor, and he really brought her up like a boy. Her mother had died when she was six. He could see certain problems that she might have from separation, and so he kept an eye on her and really indulged her in a lot of different things. If she was interested in something, he would hire tutors and that sort of thing. And then when she was 11 and 12, he brought her into his office on Saturdays and had her schedule patients. And so she was, and then he also took her on trips that he liked to make in archaeology, and he would, he took all his children, but he basically brought her up as a boy. You know, she could hunt and fish, and I think, and then of course, he taught all of his children his own philosophy, which was the importance of José Martí and the liberation of Cuba from the Spanish, etc. And so she really was brought up in this very particular way. And then, of course, when Batista returned to Cuba and with a coup d'etat, she'd been busy before that, but because lots of people hated the various governments and that were really backed by the United States mostly. And she'd been busy in small groups, but then she got very active after that.
Small groups of what or who?
Of sort of resistance groups, people who would be quasi-political, who, they backed Chibos, for example, who died in 51, but she was very busy starting in 1947 to 51 supporting him.
And what sort of contact did she have with working either in the fields, in the sugar fields, or with other kinds of ordinary and impoverished people in Cuba in this period?
Well, she grew up in Media Luna, and also, which has a really big sugar factory, and also Manzanillo is where the head of the union is, and so on. So, I mean, this is very different upbringing from someone from Havana or even Santiago. So she really was in sugar country, and her father treated all these workers who were at the sugar mills, and in 1940, her father decided to retire from a job that he had and buy a doctor's practice on the coast, and she went with him. She sort of took care of him. And so there mainly were people from the sugar mill who couldn't pay very often. I mean, this was, you know, the Depression really existed a long time in Cuba. So she was just very aware of people's problems, as her father was.
And would she, I mean, she played a role, and I'll ask you a bit more about what role she played in planning the 59 revolution, in which Castro was such an important figure. But would she have come to awareness among progressive circles, her capacities, her commitments, and so on, that she would be welcomed as a planner of what obviously was a clandestine effort to overthrow the Batista dictatorship?
Yes, I can absolutely say in one word, yes. Because she was very well organized, and so when Castro sent his kind of lieutenant, Nico Lopez, around to look at the various areas of Cuba and the political organizations, I mean, he knew that Celia was excellent. She was just very well organized. She was very detailed oriented. She worked in, she had her own organization at one point, but her name had come up in terms of, you know, Fidel was also a backer of Eduardo Chibas. And so her political activity was, you know, a good decade in the making.
And what role then did she play in planning the revolution?
So when Fidel was on the Isle of Pines, and then when he was pardoned and came into Havana and quickly set up the 26th of July movement. You know, he had had an earlier movement in the early 50s to attack the Moncada. So he had a group of people like Pedro Moret and so on who were around him who were organizers and recruiters. And he sent one of them to meet her, and you know, something fell through, but she basically was one of the founders. I mean, she was notified right away, and many people don't know this, but there were, you know, there are a lot of names that I try to include in my book, because I have this feeling that if I don't, who will? Or it's about time to start, let's put it that way.
I noticed just in listening to some of the names you've given me so far, people who were sent to contact, investigate, and so on, that they're male names. And, of course, machismo has always been an important feature of Latin American political culture and social culture. So was there any hesitation in that regard, or were people like Castro far more emancipated from that particular deformation, I would call it?
That's a funny question to answer, because Fidel basically has a history of liking women. So there's that essence of that. But to get back to the real, yes, machismo, but, you know, she seemed to know how to get around it. She, and one of the reasons why you don't know about her is, you know, she really was smart enough to keep her power when she was after the revolution triumphed. You know, she really was one of the heroes. She went about her work. She was really at Fidel's side, but you would never confuse her with some, you know, wife who is wrapped in fur and staring with, you know, adulation at her husband. She really knew, and I think this is, she knew how to take care of men. She knew how to take care of her father. She knew all that Spanish stuff of drawing his bath. You know, making sure that the cook had his breakfast ready. She would do that every day, even though it was a pattern that, you know, you didn't need to repeat. Everyone knew it. But she just knew how to do that, and I think she transferred all of that energy and finesse over to Fidel, even though it was in the hills, and she could, you know. And I just feel, I know from talking to the other commandantes who were with him, that rather than feeling anxious about having a woman around, when she was literally the only woman in the rebel army in Column 1, that Fidel felt so much more comfortable that they liked her presence. But anyway, she knew how to do that. That was no problem. She just factored that in. And then she was very smart and very articulate and very politically developed and well-educated.
And after the success of the revolution and the period of reconstructing and reorganizing Cuban society, you mentioned that when you looked at the cigar company and so on, there was a picture of her there, that her presence was in many of the architectural achievements of the society. What other things did she become involved in a day-to-day way and responsible for seeing through to success?
Taking care of women. There were so many maids and widows after the war, especially when the rich families left Havana, and, you know, in a perfect world, they would give the maids 2 weeks' wages, but that was it. They were never going to get another job, or it was very... So she made a marriage of many of these things, taking care of Fidel, which was, and Che and the whole group of the, because the assassination attempt started right away. So making a safe cigar was very important. And that's really how she started. Now, she started this factory and got only women rollers to come in. The only man in that factory was the man who actually had developed this particular cigar that Fidel liked to smoke. Which was the kind of Lancero that is now the famous young man's strong Cohiba cigar. So anyway, she also would start things like a yogurt factory and a pasta factory and employ women so that they had work to do, and it was sustaining work. And also they needed to get money into the country. And so they developed tourism, you know, see the revolution at first hand kind of thing. And so that meant building guest houses, because their idea, they forgot about the United States. They extended the new tourists to Sweden and, you know, England and all that. And the idea was come, you know, work in the sugar cane fields and things like that. And so she developed these, different architectural projects all around the country at beautiful, you know, fishing sites or something like that. And then she would have workshops to carve doors, to make, you know, chairs, tables. She wanted to have, you know, a new, fresh Cuban design. So they didn't have shoes, because everything had been imported from the United States mostly. And when the embargo went into effect in a couple of years, so she got molds from Italy and started to have plastic shoes, textiles. She started textile factories. She just really had the power to get these things in place.
What was it that inspired you to write her biography? Initially, she must have been a strange discovery, a new discovery. But why did you decide this is a biography I want to write?
Of course, my answer to that is that her name kept coming up, and I was fascinated by her. And, you know, I really don't want to sound ridiculous, but I have to say that I was still working on this large coffee table book on cigars, and I went to an extremely out-of-the-way factory, and was in Havana. But, you know, no tourists ever go there. But I went there and asked them if I could photograph. And they said, well, probably, but they had to assemble five men. And, I mean, there was head of production and there was the head of the party, certainly, for that factory. There would probably have been, I can't remember all the positions, but these were five men who were tough characters in a manager position, and finally they assembled, and in that kind of Cuban way, one of them went to the lectern and started to drone on about, you know, the factory and cigars and so on, and I interrupted him because Celia Sanchez's name came up, and so I said, wait a minute, now who is she? And they said, you don't know her? And I said, well, I know her name. And then I said, but tell me more about her. I mean, it was kind of unheard of that I did that interruption, but what happened was I watched them all exchange glances and smile and sort of pick one person, and he started to talk about her, and, you know, I just watched these men's faces change, and I was hooked.
And was it complex to get the files, the archives, the personal materials that would make a successful biography?
Well, it was complex in the sense that it's in an archive, and it's in a very finely created archive, and I think any archive, you know, you have to stand in line and give permission and so on. But they certainly gave it to me, and the director would speak to Fidel, because Fidel is so closely associated with her and seemingly so emotionally attached to her and her memory. He would turn it down, obviously. So after a while, he gave in. Put it that way. So I was able to then look at all the records, all the letters in the Sierra Maestra between her and him and her and Frank and so on. It's Ooh. A big archive, and each one of the major people have a curator. So I worked with Celia's curator, and then if I needed pick a response from Fidel, for example, we would have to go to the Fidel's curator and get those letters.
The title of the book is One Day in December. Why the title?
Well, I wanted it to be, it's a narrative. It really is. You need to read this book from front to back and pick up all the clues along the way. And it starts in December 1955 when she's tapped on the shoulder, selected by Fidel to plan the landing. And a year later, when the landing actually happens in December 1956, she's caught by the police, the secret police, and certainly would have been tortured, and she escapes. And then, in December 1959, is when they really won the war. But I also wanted to give it more of a sense of being a story inside, and also to attract the people who are maybe not going to be totally interested in the Cuban Revolution, to sort of get a sense that this is a story, and it's an adventure story. She lived a very interesting life.
Well, thank you for opening the door to our listeners and myself reading the book. I look forward to it. Thank you again.
You're welcome. And when I've been in Cuba, I've always loved all the Canadian tourists there, and so I think lots of people probably will enjoy reading it.
I'm sure they will. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. I've been speaking to Nancy Stout. She's a writer, photographer in New York. She's also a reference librarian at Fordham University. Her biography of Celia Sanchez, One Day in December, is available from Monthly Review Press. And you're listening to Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
This podcast was produced by the Red Eye Collective in Vancouver, BC. If you live in the Vancouver area and are interested in creating alternative radio with us, we'd love to hear from you. Contact us at redeye@cooperadio.org.